Well, I'm very pleased to welcome to Fremantle Shipping News Graham Henderson, a marine archaeologist of note, very well known to lots of people in Fremantle. So welcome along, Graham.
Thank you, Michael.
Now, you have all sorts of claims to fame. One of your most recent claims to fame as an author is the book Swallowed by the Sea, the story of Australia's shipwrecks, with your name beautifully printed beneath, a person all scuba'd up down the bottom of the ocean somewhere holding on to something. Can I just ask if by any chance that's you?
No, it's a lady from Queensland on a shipwreck in Queensland, and I didn't know what they'd put on the cover, in fact. We were kicking around the idea of a ship just being sunk, and that's the top half of the picture there. But I was actually surprised when they showed me this one. And then I went to a conference here in Fremantle, and the lady sitting next to me was that lady. And I'd never met her before, and she said, I'm the one on the picture.
I'm not on the picture. Well, you must have been a bit annoyed not to have yourself in the photo.
Oh, no, I wouldn't want to do that. But the National Library actually does splendid work, and it was a delight to do this book with the National Library because they've got such wonderful pictorial collections. And sometimes you find yourself working on a book. These days, I love to have good images in a book. And if you have a book which requires good images, and then you look at what the sources are, and you look at many thousands of dollars, but more than you're not likely to have come back in royalties or anything, it's great to actually do a book with a library like that, whereby they provide all those wonderful images.
Now, some of your story is well known to some people. Way back when, at least to the millennials, in about, what, 1963?
It was 1963, April Sunday, yeah.
And that's the fateful day, one might say, where you finished up swimming over, diving down on what in English is known as the Gilt Dragon.
Yeah, and it was a terrific thrill, and we were chasing fish. Gropers were in the area. They were the big attraction of the day, and it was on the outside of a reef. Good diving conditions, and that meant that the swell wasn't going to be bowling us over where the wreck was. Normally, there's a fairly high swell on the Gilt Dragon wreck, but I saw on the seabed a number of curious side-like objects, and they were elephant tusks. There was a whole stack of these tusks, probably 50 or so, all poking out of the seabed. They all disappeared pretty rapidly, I must say, after the general diving community got to know about it.
Perhaps we can get back to that, but you weren't actually looking for the Gilt Dragon that day, were you?
No, looking for fish, but by a stroke of curious fortune, a bloke called Alan Robinson was sitting in the boat at the time. He wasn't in the water when I found it, but we went back to the boat and told him that we'd found a wreck, and he jumped in the water and had a look as well. And he said, "It's not my wreck." And then later on, decided that it would be rather useful to say I made a mistake. It really was my wreck. Because he'd claimed years before to have found the Gilt Dragon, and he took Jack Sue and a couple of others down to it and started sawing away at a limestone pinnacle, these solution pipes they're called. He started sawing away at this thing with a carpenter's saw and calling it a cannon, and he was absolutely laughed out of anything on that basis. And so then, with the Gilt Dragon being found, he gave up his job. He was a fridge salesman at John Allen's store in Vic Park, and he gave up his job and set up camp on the beach up there and started looting the thing, and used gelignite, and so it caused quite a stir.
Well, for those who don't know, Robinson finished up with the Museum of Western Australia going to the High Court to work out essentially who was entitled to hold on to all of that.
Yeah, and it was all fascinating stuff, all the legal issues, but I suppose the good aspect of that was that him playing the bad boy meant that after a while the community got pretty sick of that, and legislation was passed which covered the whole of Australia. You see, he won in terms of the state legislation. The state legislation was called invalid on issues, and so it was taken off to the responsibility of the federal government to do something about it, and they passed federal legislation which meant that the whole of Australia was covered for doing what I would call more creative things with shipwrecks than blasting them apart with gelignite.
Well, that takes one back to the sort of area that I'd like to explore a little bit with you. As small boys, you read about smugglers and ships and shipwrecks, and you learn about all sorts of wrecks. I was at Rottnest recently, and the City of York managed to founder over there on Rottnest in about 1899, and you always wonder what happens and happened. How did you initially become involved in this, and when you did, just going back to the Gilt Dragon, 1963, was there any general awareness of the shipwrecks around Australia, and was there any protection for them?
There wasn't any protection for them anywhere in the world, basically. The thing was that scuba diving had been invented, you might say, and so aqualungs were one of those things that if you could get to use one for half an hour at some point, it was a terrific thrill. But at the same time, snorkeling, spearfishing was incredibly popular at that time, and there were great stories about people who could dive to 80 feet and shoot a fish and then reload and shoot another fish. You know, stories like that, real frontier kind of stuff. And there were some people who were really regarded as national heroes because they could shoot a fish better than someone else could shoot a fish. I suppose I must say I enjoy shooting a fish, so I don't compare it with elephant hunting or any such thing. I mean, I eat a fish if I shoot a fish. But in those days, there were fishing competitions whereby people would stack a whole heap of fish on the beach to rot, you know, things like that, which I think were absolutely disgraceful.
Now, there's some sort of I'm not sure if it's a symmetry, but and it's more than a segue.
With elephant hunting?
But you, yes.
No.
Well, what are these tusks you describe?
Oh, well.
On the Gilt Dragon, while you are, in fact, as a 16-year-old, engaged in the act of big game fish hunting.
Elephant tusks are an icon, and it is fascinating, that aspect of it. If you look at the internet images of Vladimir Putin, he has himself on the internet diving and recovering sunken treasure, and so bits of pottery and so forth. Elephant tusks, similarly.
Only the leader of North Korea would seem to be more accomplished than him.
Elephant tusks, similarly, are, an icon, and there's a certain swinging of the logic, you know, from shooting an elephant and holding a tusk up as not Tarzan. Who's the guy who was the European chap in Africa there in that time? But anyway, a bit like that, you know, the big game hunter, the champion who's killed the creature.
So where do you think those tusks that you finished up spotting on that wreck had come from, and why were they going where they were going?
Well, they came from southern Africa, and they were being taken to Asia for trade. And the tusks on Dutch ships and shipwrecks are a fascinating thing. I found a tusk on the a lot of tusks on the Gilt Dragon. More recently, I've been doing some research up on Christmas and Cocos. And on the Cocos Islands, a school teacher back in 1981 found an elephant tusk. Now, it's fascinating to say, where did that come from? Just a week ago, there was Hugh Edwards, the diver, who was showing a tusk that he had found on the Abrolhos. And curiously enough, there's two competing theories in regard to tusks, in regard to this.
Only two.
Well, Edwards' theory is that the tusk that he found on the wreck of the Zaywick doesn't come from the Zaywick, but comes from another ship called the Agdekirk, which happened, just by chance, happened to have been wrecked on exactly the same spot 2 years before the Zaywick. Now, the Agdekirk was known to have picked up 214 elephant tusks at Cape Town on its way out. So it's a candidate for any site that has tusks, but of course the Gilt Dragon had tusks on it too, and I know that's not the Agdekirk, and I don't see any reason to think that the Agdekirk fell onto the same spot as the Gilt Dragon. But the Gilt Dragon doesn't have elephant tusks on its manifest, and neither does the Zawick. I think in both cases they had illegal tusks. But then this tusk that's been found on Cocos Islands by the school teacher back in 1981, the DNA analysis of that puts it in the same sort of area of origin as the tusks from the Agdekirk. That is where they were collected from.
Yes.
And so it's possible that the Agdekirk, in fact, struck the Cocos rather than struck anywhere else. So that's a fascinating thing. I would dearly love to get carbon dating on the Cocos tusk, because that might tell us more about what shape it came from.
Now, just stepping back a little bit in this, I mentioned at the very outset your most recent book, Swallowed by the Sea. You've written a number of major books about wrecks and maritime matters. How many? Can you quickly rattle that off?
Oh, a dozen or so. But when I joined the museum initially, back in the 1969, I think it was, the museum put me onto the task of putting a catalogue together of all the different sites in Western Australia, and I found that wonderful fun. I found myself diving on these shipwrecks and spending a lot of time in the archives as well, and I enjoyed both. The idea of pouring through the old records and seeing what hasn't been found before there, and then going and testing these ideas in the sea. How can you beat that? Really active, aggressive underwater diving and so forth versus the passive sitting in a library.
Well, it's an interesting combination that you can do one and then go off and do the other.
Now, indeed, I met my wife in the archives.
Oh, that goes to show you there are advantages. We won't explore that on this occasion, Graham. But where does this capacity to write? Not everybody can write, and I imagine not every marine archaeologist is the greatest writer, but where does your talent come from?
Well, I'm not sure whether I can write, but I've tried on a number of occasions. And my father was a journo with the Daily News, and he used to do the courts, and he'd come back and tell us about these wonderful tales of skullduggery and so forth, and really entertain us greatly. And I found it at quite an early stage at school. I was very proud to come home with high English marks.
Now, in terms of your career, you've mentioned starting at the museum in 1969. You did tertiary studies. What did you major in?
History.
And you went through UWA?
Yeah. I did a BA and a DipEd and an MA.
And did you see yourself at that point, at least somewhere along the line of those studies, finishing up in the area that you became famous in?
Oh, very early, because when I was doing my first year history course, the lecturer, Dr. Crawford, she had a policy of having a one-on-one discussion with each of her students, and she'd say, what do you want to do in life? And I thought, I must say, I look back to that, and it was a wonderful inspiration, because no one had asked me that before, and I said, I don't know. I said, but I have found a shipwreck. And that took me on to a bit of a discussion about the Gilt Dragon, and she said, oh, my husband, Dr. Ian Crawford, he's a curator at the museum. You ought to see if you can get a job at the museum. And so I did. And I walked into the then director's office and said, I think you ought to give me a job. And basically he said, OK, but you're a bit green around the gills or something, a bit young, naive was what he meant. And he explained that the people who worked in the maritime archaeology area were basically ex-military people who were, there were the clear ex-clearance divers, those sorts of people. And the museum had taken these people on, employed them, on the basis that they needed some reasonably tough guys to deal with this rascal Robinson. And so that was the group of people that I met with when I first joined the museum. And I must say, I thought it was a wonderful adventure from the word go. One of the first times that I went up to out into the field was up to Ledge Point, where the Gilt Dragon wreck was. And when we went out to the wreck, sure enough, Alan Robinson was there. And so when we got back, I phoned the director of the museum and said, look, Alan Robinson's out of the wreck. You ought to do something about this. And so he sent the police up. And so we found that the police had suddenly arrived, and they interviewed Robinson at the slipway where he was putting his boat ashore. And he was subsequently charged with stealing a brick from the Gilt Dragon. And this is a hilarious thing, really, because he claimed that it was the brick that he had found some earlier time, and before the legislation had been passed. And the cops forgot to test it in terms of how much liquid was in the brick at the time, and so he got off on the basis of the cops not being able to prove that it had been taken from the water that day, rather than, I mean, he had this ludicrous claim that he'd taken it out on his boat from home to the wreck site and then brought it back again on his boat. Utter nonsense, but the court believed him. So he got off.
Just gets to show you how naive judges can be.
Yeah, they are.
Now, back in those days, just take Western Australia as an example, but a very good one. Did we know here just how many, anywhere near how many shipwrecks possibly there could be on the WA coast?
No, and I'm pleased to say that I was the one who managed to tell them, because I was given this job, this task at the museum to do a catalogue and figure out how many there were. So I went through the Lloyd's records and the newspapers and all those sorts of things. And as I say, that was the archival side.
So it was primary research that you were conducting.
Yeah, yeah.
And in very much an overview, what sort of distribution of wrecks over what sort of period do we see? Just start with perhaps roughly when you think the earliest would be there.
The earliest was 1622. That's the trial, an English ship. And that's the fascinating thing about the trial is that people never talk about the trial.
No,
we all talk about the Dutch in 1629, the Batavia, and 56, the Gilt Dragon, and so it goes. But I guess the Dutch wrecks have really taken to the public imagination because there's such a wonderful, exotic collection of artefacts from them, together with pretty good stories. Of course, the trial had a reasonable story with it, with the skullduggery that was going on with the captain and the crew, but they all had good stories, really.
So what was the trial doing in these parts?
Well, it was doing exactly the same sort of thing as the Dutch, but the Dutch told the English how to get across the southern Indian Ocean, and so the trial was one of the first English ships to head out on that lonesome journey, a bit like going to Mars, and it didn't make it.
Where was it headed?
Heading for Java.
So the Dutch and the English were not in any state of war, but friendship at that point.
I'm not sure whether I'd call it friendship. They didn't like each other, and there was the odd mass killing between the two. They fought just about all the time.
But they passed on that much of the sailing story to enable the trial to get this way.
Yeah, yeah.
Now, do you think that there would be other wrecks that precede 1622? When do you think that the Dutch or the English, or for that matter any other of the sailing nations would have been in these parts?
Well, of course, 1606, the Dyfken comes to the Northern Territory, a bit of Queensland, with a journey that was trying to find gold in New Guinea, essentially. And then 1616, Dirk Hartog had his ship go a bit further east than it should have. And Dirk Hartog really put Australia on the map. The Dyfken, the story was lost for some time, and the records are slightly second hand. But it's quite clear that it did come. But Dirk Hartog spent a bit of time here, and so suddenly the Dutch were well and truly aware of a continent being here.
Mm. Now, in terms of the protections, you've met Ellen Robinson, we've mentioned the litigation, and it's probably in its various forms as to whom these various artefacts belonged. When did Western Australia start taking quite seriously its heritage, and how did it develop that? We know today we've got the Shipwreck Museum in Fremantle, there's the Maritime Museum as well. You've had a long involvement with all of that. How did that develop, and did it require some development of public and political support for it to happen?
I think it was incredibly lucky to have the things that happened. The downside was Robinson and one or two others who were looting things, but that brought public attention, and there was a good strong combination between the newspaper people who were really interested in diving and the shipwrecks and the question of the protection of them, and the politicians at the time. Charlie Court was really good. He was a great one for developing a maritime museum. And I recall he used to come down soon after the maritime museum had been completed. He'd come down and tell me, I was the director by then, he'd tell me what to do about various things, which I thought was rather good to have a Premier come and tell me how to do my business as a lowly museum person, but it was terrific having that sort of support. He had come to functions and so forth, so the political side was really, really strong, and the newspaper side was strong, and the community went along with that.
Now, was there a point as the extent of the shipwreck heritage, if you like, the legacy, the bounty, the booty, caused countries like Australia and the Netherlands and others to start talking about to whom this all belonged, or who had interests and how they ought to be regulated?
Well, as I said, we were one of the first countries in the world to develop legislation, and we are still regarded as a world leader in this sort of thing. I personally took a strong interest in the concept of protection and trying to encourage other countries to do the same thing. And some years ago, ICOMOS, an Australian, well, an international group that looks after cultural heritage, invited me to develop a committee to look at the idea of whether a convention could be developed, an international UNESCO convention could be developed to protect shipwrecks all around the world. And indeed, 2001, that convention was the first stages of that convention were put into place. I had this wonderful committee of 18 people from around the world, and we had discussions about what are the benefits of having good protection, and there's now this convention in place, UNESCO convention, which essentially is international law.
Now, when it comes to the development of, if you like, archaeological or heritage protection policy and practice, are there developments? Is it to be equated in any way with the built environment heritage that we have on the land? Do you try to keep things in situ to be enjoyed there? To what extent do you necessarily take them out of the water, off the rocks or cliffs where they've founded and brought into buildings? Are they always to be like animals in a zoo if you want to see them, or are you able to go out on safari?
Well, there's different approaches taken in different places, and I think it's good that there are different approaches, but the concept of see and don't touch, I think, is a wonderful idea with the vast majority of the underwater cultural heritage. But now and again, there's an opportunity to do something which really can be terrific in terms of research, education, general information for the community. So I think in the case of the Batavia, the idea of leaving the Batavia timbers on the seabed for a future generation, that might be a fine idea, but it wouldn't have brought the awareness of the Australian and international communities about history in the same way. And so I think it was a splendid idea for the museum to raise those timbers from the Batavia. There has to be restraint from the point of view of the archaeologists. If everything is ripped out of the seabed, then obviously there's going to be nothing for future researchers for a start, and there's no point in doing such things unless you've got a really good argument for doing it. And so I think the idea of leave alone in the vast majority of cases, but if there's a really good argument for raising something, then you do it.
Now, given your wide knowledge and the depth of it about wrecks, let's go beyond Western Australia. Let's just think about the whole of Australia. We can go beyond that. We can include some of our offshore territories. Are there wrecks that you believe are there to be found that we just haven't found yet? Are there any sort of great lingering mysteries? Took us a long time to find the Sydney, but are there such wrecks in our geographical waters?
Well, just last week, actually 2 days ago, someone told me that the AE-1 had been found. I don't think it has, actually, but there is a search going on for it at the moment. There's a local group, Bob Trotter and a few others, who've been working with some of the people still in the Navy. This Australian submarine that was wrecked up in Indonesia and in deep water, and it was... that's been a mystery throughout, and I think it's bound to be found sometime soon, but a lot of searching's been done for it. And of course the AE-2, the submarine that was...
This is the first war, isn't it?
Yeah.
They brought them out, was that a presentation a year or so ago from England in order to be in the Australian Navy, weren't they?
Sorry, what?
They were brought out from Europe in order to in the Australian Navy.
Yeah, and... there was a lot of discussion about the question of whether it might be advisable to try and raise that. But my personal view is raising old submarines from the seabed is going to be a hell of a lot of conservation problems, and with, I think, probably more effort than reward. And so I'm pleased that they haven't tried to raise the AE-2. But... a fascinating story, the AE-2, with the book that's been done on it, with the prisoner of war camp and all that sort of thing.
Now, let's just swing to the other side of Australia, to the original Sydney Cove settlement with Governor Phillip. Do we know where all the ships from that original voyage, that first fleet, have finished up?
There's very little knowledge about that. One of the early vessels is one of a number sunk in a port in America, and the question of whether they have actually specifically identified it or not is not clear to me at this stage. But the Sirius is the really exciting one, and I'm delighted to say that I've had quite a bit of experience with the Sirius wreck.
Now, what
the Sirius
was
essentially the flagship of the
fleet. It was the flagship. And what happened with the Sirius? I think in Sydney, down near Circular Quay, there's a big anchor from it. Where's the rest of it?
There's a big anchor near Circular Quay. There's another anchor in the forecourt of the front gallery of the National Maritime Museum in Sydney. But there's also a serious museum on Norfolk Island. And the story in terms of the wreck is the ship brought the first fleet out in 1788, and then by 1790, the colony looked like it was going to be starving because the future ships weren't arriving, and the expected ships weren't arriving, and the Brits didn't know how to grow crops in Australia. So they were looking like starving, and so they decided that they would send most of the convicts off to Norfolk Island, where it was thought that they would be able to forage better than they would be able to if it came to it in wild Australia. And so the Sirius, with a smaller vessel called the Supply, went off to Norfolk Island, and they got there. This is in March 1790. And they went to one side of the island and it was too rough, and they went to the other side and it was too rough, and then they came back to the first side of the island, which is the south side, and by that time they were pretty desperate to land the provisions and convicts. And anyway, what happened was that the ship drifted a bit closer to the shore than Captain Hunter realised, and then when he went to tack, to sail out of that bay, the ship didn't answer its helm, is the way he put it. That is, it failed to tack. It failed to change direction. So that was trying to go upwind. He then tried to wareship, that is to jibe the ship, go turn around by going downwind. And the ship wouldn't do that either. So then the ship fell backwards onto the reef, because it had failed to steer, essentially. And so it was a terrible disaster for the colony. The ship broke up almost immediately. And the governor, Arthur Phillip, decided to leave pretty soon after that. And then a couple more supply ships came along. And so Australia is Australia.
So Syria stayed where it was, or most of it stayed where it was, I guess, for a while. But you had occasion, though, to dive on it, I think.
Yeah, well, when it came to the bicentenary, 1988, a bit before that, there was a group called the Australian Bicentennial Authority was developed, and they invited me to go and see where the wreck was. And it was known that several anchors had been raised, but no one knew the actual wreck site. And I was able to bring together a group of people from around Australia for what was called a bicentennial project. And we found the wreck, that is the centre of the wreck, and that consisted of a big heap of ballast. That was a fascinating thing, because I've done quite a bit more research on the ballast. It's stuff called kentledge, which is big rectangular pieces of iron, and they were specially made to a certain size and weight, and they were fitted around the keel of ships at the time. And there was actually legislation saying how much of this ballast should be on a ship of a particular rate. And so we have documentary evidence of how much of this ballast should have been on the Sirius. Now, a fascinating aspect from my point of view is that Arthur Phillip, when he was Captain Arthur Phillip in 1787, he decided to take most of the ballast off because he wanted to put more cows and people and general provisions on the ship.
Human and animal ballast.
Yeah, yeah. Because, of course, this is good logic in terms of practicality for the time. To be able to take more provisions out was going to make a better colony. But, of course, in the longer term, what it meant was, this is the theory I'm working on, and I'm not quite sure I'm right yet, but if you then take the cows and things off, you've got a very light ship if you've taken your ballast off previously. And you don't get kentledge ballast, that's these big iron blocks, in remote Australia of that time. So for several years, the Sirius was sailing about without, as I understand it, the appropriate ballast. Then, of course, it fails to answer its helm, and my understanding is that if a ship doesn't have the right ballast, then it can't necessarily answer its helm. So what we're doing now, next week I'm going over to Norfolk Island to do photogrammetric work on the ballast mound. There's new techniques. You take a lot of photographs and then you put them into a computer, and you can work out what the mass of something is. And if you can work out what the mass of ballast is on the Sirius, then you can work out what the weight, and therefore you can work out what ballast is there, was there when the ship sank.
Yes.
And you can compare that with what it should have had.
Should have been.
And you can then, I will then take it to naval architects and say, right, what's the stability issues of that amount of ballast being taken out?
Does it help to explain not answering the helm?
Yeah, yeah.
And you think it does. Now, that's not all you found on the Sirius, though, is it? You found some interesting Aboriginal material culture there.
Yeah, well, that was absolutely fascinating. We picked up a lot. There was, other than the iron ballast, there was a lot of what's called shingle ballast on the wreck, and that's essentially Thames flint. These little round water washed pebbles that they picked up in the Thames River before they came out, and among that ballast, we found, to our great surprise, an Aboriginal stone hatchet head. And that's been identified as having come from a bit north of Sydney. And that's the sort of place where there would have been exploratory visits by the Sirius prior to going out to Norfolk. And so obviously that's either going to be a case of trade or one of the crew doing a bit of souvenir hunting. And a fascinating question for me is, are there more of these in the shingle ballast that's still lying on the wreck?
Fascinating. Now, leaving the Sirius for a minute, what other things in the course of your long career as a hunter of ships, let's say, have you found that took your breath away?
Well, something I'd like to take my breath away is finding the Eendracht. The Eendracht was Dirk Hartog's ship, and at the moment, I got together with several others to form a group called Wreck Check. And our mission is that we've devised for ourselves is to learn more about the underwater cultural heritage in places that aren't around the direct coastline of Australia. So for several years, we've been looking at Christmas Island and Cocos with searches because we know we have good evidence that there's a number of Dutch shipwrecks have been passing by that way, and certain evidence that it would imply that one or two have actually struck there. And so we've been looking up there, but I'm also very interested in the idea of trying to follow up on the wreck of the Eendracht. It came here to Western Australia in 1616, and then in 1622 it was wrecked somewhere near Ambon. And I did some correspondence with archivists who were looking at some of the archives in Indonesia, and they have given me information that gives me a pretty good idea of where it struck a particular point. Now, it broke up immediately, and so it should be, there should be part of the wreck at least, very close to that point. So we'd like to, our wreck check people, we'd like to go and have a look there. Having a look for shipwrecks in Indonesia is something that requires a lot of preparation in terms of communication with governments and new tape on.
So with the liaising with countries like Indonesia, there must be a lot of legwork to be done there. And is that governed by the convention you discussed earlier, or do separate arrangements get put in place with the government of that country?
Well, the fascinating aspect of that is that the people who are looking at doing this feel themselves governed by that convention, but in fact, Australia hasn't ratified that convention yet. Indonesia hasn't ratified that convention either. The Dutch are in the process of ratifying that convention, and we'd like to make it a three-way project to have the Dutch involved, the Indonesians involved, and the Australians involved. So we're working as though the convention does apply in, with each of those countries, and having government-to-government communication, or us to government. You see, because we're not government, RecCheck is not government, but we're dealing with governments on the matter.
Now, the answer to this question, might, in a sense, be obvious, Graham, but it requires some articulation, I think. Why do we see value? Why do we want to find and, in a sense, save and record and preserve these historic shipwrecks?
Well, when you say, why do we, I guess I don't know why other people would want to, in one sense. Why do I? It's been a lifelong, wonderful obsession from my point of view. I love the whole concept of being involved with these things, finding out. That's what it's all about for me.
Finding out what?
Finding out about our history and the wonderful stories that we have in terms of our history. When I started to be interested in this sort of thing, we used to look to the east coast of Australia in terms of early history. When we got going with the interest in the Dutch wrecks, in a sense it was colonial pride, west coast pride, that we were before the east coast in terms of this European involvement with the place. There are so many different directions that your interest might go in that regard, but I think that our history, particularly for Western Australia, has developed so much more with the finding of the Dutch wrecks, and the wrecks generally are a wonderful way of looking at history. There's lots of material that lasts. Just looking at the artifact collections that you find on shipwrecks, it's the sort of thing, because it's accidents that have happened, it means that people don't have the opportunity to remove all sorts of things. With land archaeology, so many land archaeological sites, just the bricks and mortar left because all the contents have gone. In the case of the shipwrecks, they're disaster sites. So it's a bit like when there's a volcano, cover everything with lava.
Now, Fremantle has, in a sense, exploited, taken advantage of, developed its own, perhaps unique, maybe not unique, connection with all of this. We have the Shipwrecks Museum here in Fremantle, and we have the Maritime Museum. I use the word unique, it gets overused, but how special is that, or those places, to the state, to Fremantle, or on a larger scale?
Well, for me, they're absolutely special. I recall at a very early point in my career having Christmas dinner with my wife's parents and a chap from across the road who had been mayor of Fremantle at an earlier stage. And I would always tell him about my interests, and I said, oh, we don't have enough room in the building that we've got, which was an old shed behind the commissariat, behind the old women's asylum. We don't have enough room for all the artefacts that we're getting. And he said, oh, why don't you come and have a look at this other building, which is a derelict building, and we on the council aren't sure what we're going to do with it. And it was the commissariat building, and I went down there with him, and there were trucks driving through the place doing terrible things to the fabric of the building. And I immediately just about fell over with delight looking at what a wonderful building it was. And I went straight off to the director of the museum up in Perth and said, look, we've got to get this building for the Maritime Museum. And he immediately said, yeah, and we'll try. And he immediately went off to Charles Court, and Charles Court was thrilled about the idea, and it all just happened so quickly. And we had this magnificent building all of a sudden. So that building is, you know, absolutely a delight from my point of view. But then at a later point in my career, I thought, wouldn't it be great to have something that was going to cater for not just our shipwrecks, but all those wonderful boats that represent Western Australia. And so I started pushing for another building, and ultimately we got it. And this was, bizarrely, this was a good deal to do with Charles's son, Richard, because Richard was really keen on the idea of the America's Cup. We, at the museum, felt that Australia too had been pinched from us by the National Maritime Museum. So I got going with a bit of a campaign to try and get that vessel back to Western Australia. And Richard Court said his government will build a building for Australia too. Well, the idea of a building just for Australia too, I didn't have any interest whatsoever in that. But I'm delighted to say that when I talked to him, the idea of a much broader concept of something that would be a real maritime museum for a general collection, he was really interested in that, and he took a very strong part in terms of some of the architectural aspects of that. And it was fascinating going to meetings with the architects, and he would come along and say, "Oh, don't like that bit of it. It looks like a toilet on the side of it there." And so, like his father, he took a strong, direct interest in this, and I thought that was absolutely wonderful.
And you're retired from your position there, but do you maintain a strong active interest in what's happening?
Yeah, of course. And I think it's a splendid concept that we have here in WA, and I'd like to see it develop further. One of the things that I used to try to push for was the idea of having some space in the water somewhere where you could actually have a few of these boats to push in and do interesting things in the water. And I think if we were able to do that, it would be a good way of us being able to get a closer connection with those people in the community who are all about their boats. And there's lots of them. They tend to be people who they don't show themselves very much because they're off working on their boats all the time. But to have a spot where they were able to come together with the museum and in showing off their boats in different ways, that would be a splendid idea, I think.
So you're talking about craft of different shapes and sizes with their own histories, wooden hull, different eras, and sort of educating people in some way? Or yeah. Can you explain that further?
Yeah, I think all of that. And there's a group called the Maritime Heritage Association. I went to their annual Christmas show just 2 days ago, and there's some absolutely fantastic stories coming from those guys. They're interested in model making. They're interested in sailing their own boats. They're interested in the stories that associated with these things. They go off to Indonesia and spend time there working on boats in Indonesia. And I suppose they might be considered a bit eccentric in ways, but I think we need to have a diverse community in those sorts of regards.
And where would this, sounds like a slipyard almost, but where would this be in your plan?
Well, I've got to say, my dream was a takeover of the far west end of Fremantle. The idea of a kind of a getting together of the port, the TAFE, the museum and the council all saying, OK, let's make the far west end of Fremantle a maritime precinct. I think if that was really entered into by all those groups in a serious way, it would be a real world beater.
Now, in this large space that we've been talking about, traversing your career really in this area of marine archaeology, are there any other dreams, plans, things you'd like to see happen, particularly in Fremantle?
Well, I think once it becomes a maritime precinct for the West End, I don't ask for anything more.
That's it. Now, as we get close to finishing, again, the answer to this question might be obvious, but if there's any young girl or boy out there who thinks I would like to be a marine archaeologist, what sorts of practical and other skills do they need? What do you have to have by way of attributes to enter into and succeed in this area?
Well, pretty much now, you need a PhD. I know when I started in it, when we tried to recruit people, you know, the question of whether they had a university degree or not, of any kind or not, was a vague sort of question. But nowadays, yeah, a person's got to be fully qualified and have other attributes as well as a PhD.
And what are the other attributes?
Oh, well, I think they need to have practical skills and be an outgoing sort of person who really is genuine. Well, there's different requirements too for different situations. So we've always had the... In the museum, I've always felt... I say we have always. I'm a research associate with the museum, but I haven't actually been working there in a professional capacity on a paid basis since 2009. But in terms of the sort of people who join museums, you have a whole swag of different skills required, and some people never go near the water and don't need to. The people who are involved in the archival side, the practical skills of drawing and cataloguing and all these sorts of things. Then you have the people who are really keen on doing the practical outdoor sort of things. And these days, I think what's happening more and more is that people have to have all those skills. They have to have the skills that inside the building and the skills outside. In the early days, if a person knew how to run a boat, then that was one of their skills. These days, that's just, you know, accepted.
Yes. Well, Graham, thank you very much for sharing a lot about your career with us, about shipwrecks, so important to what happens at Fremantle for the reason you've described. And let's see what happens to this idea about turning the far west end that you've described into something bigger and better in terms of marine museums and related activities. So thanks once again for joining us.
Thank you.